system. And that is a strategy to get people to not care.
Are you suing the police department and the officers?
Yes, we filed suit already in this case, and we're still battling in that situation. Now that this video is going to be released, that should be very helpful to our case. But, you know, in these situations, even if we do win in the end, no amount of money is going to bring Alton back. It won't bring Cameron's father back. You know, I talk to Cameron all the time, and he's having a rough time dealing with this, as all his children are. And it just shouldn't have happened because these officers escalated the entire situation.
Chris Stewart, I want to thank you for being with us, attorney for Alton Sterling's children. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez will moderate a discussion tonight at Rutgers University with Intercept's Jeremy Scahill and Sean King at 6:15 at Rutgers University, College Avenue Academic Building, 15 Seminary Place, New Brunswick. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. It is 5 o'clock, and coming up next, we have KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Afghanistan to India, a rubab sitar duet, on Saturday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall in Portland. Join rubab master Humayun Saki for his first performance in Oregon and sitarist Josh Feinberg for short solo sets. Then they will play a set together in the second half of the concert. Refreshments and concessions will be served. Again, that's Afghanistan to India, a rubab sitar duet, on Saturday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Thank you, KBOO members, for supporting this great station, and you can apply today to join our board of directors to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to great use. The role played by our KBOO board of directors is essential. It's a great way to become part of the team that is guiding our daily work and representing the interests and visions of all our members. There is a time commitment of about 15 hours a month, and you must be a KBOO member. To apply, go to kboo.fm and fill out an application, or stop by the station to pick up a paper copy. The deadline to apply is April 16, 2018. We need folks who love KBOO and are committed to our community values. KBOO needs you. Apply today. And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an audit of the Portland Police Gang Enforcement Unit has found that the unit has disproportionately targeted African Americans in the city.
Ecuador has cut WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange's internet connection from their London embassy, where he has been living for almost 6 years.
And Kim Jong-un went to Beijing this weekend, where he met with Chinese President Xi Jinping and pledged his commitment to denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 28th, 2018. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. After a lifelong relationship, KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is breaking up with America.
America, you've lost it. Kim Jong-un made his first foreign visit to China. Everyone has signed the Paris Accords but us. Our closest allies are Saudi Arabia and Israel. The only things we lead the world in are prisoners, medical costs, and weapons. Europeans seized America because they had no trees or land left. Now that America's been clear-cut, open-pitted, and fracked, now that the worst possible example of American is our face and voice across the world, I'm divorcing you, America. I know you'll get everything, and I'll have to keep paying alimony taxes. I'm an Oregonian, a Southeast Portlander, an underpublished poet, an assistant community gardener. I pledge allegiance to the earth, my neighborhood, and the loving beauty in each of us. My anthem is anything that gets us off our butts and dancing. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
An audit of the Portland Police Gang Enforcement Unit has found that the unit has disproportionately targeted African Americans in the city. According to the audit, gang enforcement officers used traffic stops as a pretext with no investigative reason for the traffic stops. 59% of those stopped were black. Officers failed to record the results of these stops, how many were actually gang members, and whether weapons or other items were seized. The numbers we do have access to from 2016 show that weapons were seized in just 2% of those traffic stops. Only 9% of Portland's population is African American, although the police department claims that, quote, most gang shootings in Portland are committed by African American gangs. The police bureau has offered no data to back up that statement.
In other Oregon news, a former Oregon State University student has been charged in federal court with threatening a shooting at Oregon State University in Corvallis. Christopher Adam Strahan was originally charged in Benton County Circuit Court, but was handed over to federal authorities on Tuesday. He made the threats on Twitter, and this was the second time that he had faced charges for making such threats. Federal prosecutors charged Strahan with threatening to injure a person through interstate communication. That charge carries a maximum sentence of 5 years imprisonment upon conviction.
European auto giants Daimler and BMW are combining their car-sharing businesses, Car2Go, ReachNow, and RideNow. Daimler's Car2Go's largest U.S. market is Seattle, with more than 113,000 members. The service has 3.1 million members and 14,000 cars globally, including 1 million members in North America. BMW's ReachNow has more than 80,000 members and 1,300 cars in Seattle, Portland, and Brooklyn. RideNow, the larger European version, has over 1 million customers. The deal will also power expansion in ride-hailing, parking, and electric vehicle charging services.
After the announcement that the 2020 census will ask a question about U.S. citizenship, a multi-state lawsuit against the Trump administration has ensued. Ellen Rosenblum, Oregon Attorney General, has joined the lawsuit. Bob Ferguson, Washington Attorney General, has also joined the suit. The suit claims that the U.S. citizenship question violates the 14th Amendment and the Enumeration Clause of the Constitution. Rosenblum said, quote, "An accurate census is a bedrock of our democracy. There is simply no requirement or need for a citizenship question on the census, but is consistent with the Trump administration's poor behavior when it comes to threatening to cut off federal funds to the states and marginalizing taxpaying, contributing residents of our communities."
A district judge in Boston has dropped all charges against 13 climate activists who sabotaged sections of an oil pipeline. The so-called valve turners argued in court that their civil disobedience action was necessary to save the planet. Speaking on the steps outside the courthouse following the verdict, defendant and noted climate activist Tim DeChristopher said that they had asked the judge to recognize that the evidence was out there. The defendants argued that the government response to climate change has been a failure. They said that it has become necessary for regular folks to act to prevent this harm.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A Montana civil rights panel is seeking to learn more about alleged discrimination impacting Native Americans, in particular with law enforcement and in the criminal justice system. Jackie Yamanaka of Yellowstone Public Radio has a preview of Thursday's hearing.
The Montana Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights called Thursday's hearing because it has follow-up questions to testimony it heard from its 2016 gathering on Bordertown discrimination. Gwen Kircher chairs the Montana committee.
People are still subject to having racial slurs spoken to them by the authorities and the officials. So these are things that we need to investigate to get them changed.
It's an allegation that Billings Police Chief Rich St. John takes seriously.
Any type of discrimination or bias-based policing is illegal.
As well as against their policy and procedure, he says. St. John says any complaints filed are thoroughly investigated. Kircher agrees and praises St. John for that.
And any complaint that has ever been filed against the Billings Police Department that I have been aware of has shown that they have done exactly as they should, and there was no racial bias.
Still, she says, the Montana Advisory Committee wants to investigate the broader issue of how Native Americans are treated by the criminal justice system. Others who are scheduled to testify are officials from counties that border the reservations. This includes other law enforcement officials and prosecutors. Public testimony will also be gathered. People can submit their testimony in person, via email, via telephone, mail, or fax. The committee's findings will be submitted to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. For National Native News, I'm Jackie Yamanaka in Billings, Montana.
An Addiction Action Committee has been formed by the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. The tribes are seeking to reduce opioid and other substance abuse issues among their community members. The committee plans to focus on efforts to expand resources and increase access to prevention, treatment, and recovery services. In addition, cultural solutions will be developed to help in areas of public safety and drug court. In a press release, Tlingit and Haida President Richard Peterson says the opioid crisis is having a negative impact on his people. Peterson says the tribe plans to collaborate with various governments, medical providers, and other institutions. Tribes across the country are taking steps to tackle opioid-related problems, including by filing lawsuits against drug makers and distributors. A federal court Tuesday ruled the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services violated the Head Start Act when it reduced funding of more than $7 million for the Navajo Nation. The court ruled the agency owes the tribe an opportunity to appeal the decision. Earlier this year, funding was reduced from $23 million to $15.7 million following allegations of under-enrollment. The Navajo program with 90 centers is one of the largest tribal Head Start programs in the United States. The tribe says funding loss would require more than 100 layoffs, center hour cuts, and the closure of many Head Start programs. In Winnipeg, at-risk youth will soon have a 24-hour safe place to go, 7 days a week. The Canadian government announced this week plans to expand a youth resource center to set up the Safe Place program. It will be named after Tina Fontaine. Fontaine's case prompted Canada's national investigation into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. In 2014, Fontaine went missing and was later found dead in a river. The center will provide an alternative to the streets for young people and help them with support and resources. According to Indigenous Services Canada, Tina Fontaine's family is in support of it being named in honor of the teenager. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Now it's time for the Daily National Newscast from the Public News Service. The Public News Service has bureaus in 36 states dedicated to news in the public interest.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Wednesday, March 28, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. North Korea's Kim Jong-un makes a surprise visit to Beijing. Also on the Wednesday rundown, civil rights leaders condemn a citizenship question on the census, and a dignity bill in Kentucky said to be a game changer for women behind bars. Now our top story, the New York Times reports North Korean leader Kim Jong-un made an unannounced visit to Beijing, meeting with President Xi Jinping weeks before planned summit meetings with American and South Korean leaders. The Times says the visit amounted to Mr. Kim's international debut. It was the 34-year-old leader's first trip outside of North Korea since he took power in 2011 and his first meeting with another head of state. The Times adds the surprise discussions added another layer of complexity to the rush of global diplomacy around North Korea's nuclear weapons program. Civil rights leaders are slamming a Trump administration decision to put a citizenship question on the 2020 census survey for the first time since the 1950s.
U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross defends the move, saying the data is necessary to enforce the Voting Rights Act. But Vanita Gupta, with the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, says the question could cause a serious undercount of immigrants and calls it a poison for democracy.
And the civil rights community is speaking with a clear and united voice. This decision is wrong for our country, it's wrong for our communities, and it's wrong for our democracy, and we will fight to overturn it.
The fear is that people who are citizens but may have undocumented members of their household will see that question and decline to participate in the census. The survey takes place every 10 years and is used to lay out congressional districts and divvy up federal funds for crucial services like public safety, health care, transportation, and education.
By the way, statistics show most of the nation's immigrants cluster in 20 American cities, mostly in blue states that did not support President Trump in the last election. And while much of the nation has been focused on Trump administration scandals, a new report shows Congress has been busy doing Wall Street's bidding. The sixth annual report by the group Americans for Financial Reform says since last year, the House Financial Services Committee passed more than six dozen bills to loosen restrictions on the financial industry, with the support of virtually all Republicans and an occasional Democrat. Report co-author James Lardner cites one bill signed by President Trump in October. It allows companies to force consumers who allege fraud into arbitration, keeping them from filing a class action lawsuit.
The result is that if you're cheated by your credit card company or your student lender or what have you, and they're perfectly entitled to say you're not allowed to go to court and you're not allowed to band together with other people who've been cheated in the same way.
Lardner notes it was the secrecy of mandatory arbitration that allowed Wells Fargo to get away with creating fake accounts for 4 years. He adds the tax bill greatly benefited Wall Street. A new law that would bring Colorado up to date with federal policies for changing a person's gender on their birth certificate won bipartisan support to clear the state house. Eric Galatis has been talking with proponents who are now pulling out all stops after the bill was assigned to the Senate's so-called Kill Committee.
Daniel Ramos with the group One Colorado says eliminating barriers for changing gender is important because when someone's identity doesn't match what's listed on their birth certificate, it can lead to discrimination.
It's important for transgender people to also have the freedom to live their lives, to be treated with dignity and respect, to be able to access employment, housing, and access to businesses and other services just like everybody else.
Ramos says the current policy is unnecessarily burdensome and a violation of privacy. Under Colorado law, people must undergo surgery and then make their case before a judge in order to win a court order allowing the change. The Birth Certificate Modernization Act would only require a letter from a health professional. Opponents of the bill warn it could encourage fraud or allow people to get out of criminal or credit history.
The U.S. is exporting more man-made fiber, textiles, and apparel in the global market, increasing by more than $3 billion in 2017 from $74 billion the year before. Stephanie Carson reports Tennessee is a big part of that.
It ranks fifth in the country for textile jobs that employ almost 14,000 people in the state. The new figures from the National Council of Textile Organizations show even more potential for growth in the area of man-made fiber, and Lloyd Wood with the trade group says the volunteer state has an advantage over neighboring states.
Tennessee is particularly strong in carbon fiber with the Oak Ridge Labs. And if you're talking about carbon fiber, if you're talking about other man-made fibers, Tennessee is number one in the country in those jobs.
And finally, Mary Sherman tells us a Kentucky lawmaker is hopeful a bill that would improve outcomes for women in prison will soon be approved by the state house.
Senator Julie Rocky Adams co-sponsored Senate Bill 133, which she says would address unfavorable conditions for women in prison, including access to basic health and hygiene services. She explains the state's correctional facilities were originally built for men and are ill-equipped to handle the recent rise in the female population.
Our female prison population is struggling to get the personal items they need, feminine hygiene products, and there's even a lot of problems with them having undergarments that are appropriate. And in Kentucky, we still shackle women while they're giving birth.
Adams adds one in four women entering the prison population either has an infant or is pregnant, and some are struggling with drug addiction.
SB 133 passed the Senate earlier this month and was recently sent to the House Rules Committee. That's our news for now. I'm Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for news from the VOO. At 6 o'clock, it's The Underground, followed at 7 o'clock by Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will be mostly cloudy with a low of 42, and tomorrow it'll be mostly sunny with a high of 61. Today in history, in 1979, was when the Three Mile Island nuclear accident began. Over 100,000 people evacuated the area. Since that accident at Three Mile Island, not a single new nuclear power plant has been ordered in the United States. Our quote of the day is from President Ronald Reagan, who said, "All the waste in a year from a nuclear power plant can be stored beneath a desk."
And now it's time for Labor History in 2 from Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1979. That was the day the Three Mile Island Unit 2 reactor partially melted down near Middletown, Pennsylvania. A combination of equipment failure and human error has long been attributed as the cause of the meltdown. An initial overheating and reactor shutdown had occurred, but a pressure valve remained stuck open, allowing coolant to escape. Design flaws in control equipment failed to indicate the position of the valve. Workers then mistook the increased pressure as a result of the excess coolant. They shut off the emergency water system that could have cooled the core. Fears of radiation release and hydrogen bubbles led to voluntary evacuations that included over 140,000 residents. Authorities assured the public that the partial meltdown had been contained. President Carter convened a commission to investigate the causes. It concluded that while the operators took inappropriate actions, the training they received was inadequate, as were the procedures they were required to follow. Plant designers Babcock and Wilcox were held responsible for poor design. The company failed to notify operators of repeated valve failure and a previous near duplicate of the potential catastrophe at the Davis-Bessey plant. Metropolitan Edison, General Public Utilities, and the NRC were also held responsible for poor quality control, poor maintenance, communication lapses, and poor training. Fears regarding public health and safety intensified, fueling health studies of those exposed and the anti-nuclear power movement. The aftermath brought about sweeping changes involving emergency response planning, reactor operator training, human factors, engineering, radiation protection, and many other areas of nuclear plant power operations. It also caused the NRC to tighten and heighten its regulatory oversight. All of these changes significantly enhanced U.S. reactor safety.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Climate Connections focuses on how climate change affects our daily lives. Today, they're taking a look at...
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In the spring, gardeners dig their hands into cool soil, dreaming of the sweet peas, crisp peppers, and juicy tomatoes to come. Sarah Vaya, a professor at the University of Maryland College Park, says when raising veggies, gardeners should be mindful of the changing climate.
In the northeast of Maryland, we're having an earlier spring and a later fall, so we have a longer growing season.
That means gardeners can start their crops sooner.
As long as they're careful, and if there is going to be a frost, they cover up their plant.
Starting a garden earlier can also give plants time to mature before the heat of summer, which is getting hotter as the climate warms.
Warmer nights, we know, can prevent some plants from flowering, like peppers and lima beans. And hot days can prevent successful pollination in tomatoes and sweet corn. And so you get tomatoes that are sort of concave because they don't have any seeds. And sweet corn, you don't get enough kernels on the ear.
Hot days can also lead to drier soil.
It's really important to mulch around the plants because that conserves the moisture and also keeps the soil cool.
So with preparation and care, gardeners can continue to harvest tasty rewards even as the climate warms. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Now it's time for the Green News Report, the newscast on environmental issues and climate change.
The implications of living in the nation's oil and gas capital became all too clear after Hurricane Harvey slammed Houston last August.
Hurricane Harvey's toxic legacy, much worse than publicly revealed. EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt gives another gift to the auto industry. Plus,
I will never sign another bill like this again. I'm not going to do it again.
Massive omnibus bill has good news for national parks, firefighting, and a tiny village in Alaska.
All of that surprising good news and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, so the Hurricane Harvey response wasn't quite as impressive as Donald Trump pretended?
Yeah, that's definitely the case. 6 months after Hurricane Harvey hit Houston, Texas, and shattered the record for the largest single deluge ever recorded in U.S. history, a massive study of county, state, and federal records conducted by the Associated Press and the Houston Chronicle has found that Harvey had a much more widespread toxic impact than has been previously made public. The reporters cataloged more than 100 releases of more than a dozen toxic chemicals and carcinogens that were released into neighborhoods and waterways. Yet officials at the time assured the public that the post-storm pollution posed little to no health threat. The analysis found only a handful of these industrial spills have been investigated by federal regulators, and state regulators have taken no enforcement actions at all for these toxic releases. Meanwhile, a heads up, Bloomberg News reports that Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt will soon begin the formal process of aggressively weakening fuel economy standards that were set under the Obama administration. This would be for new vehicles starting in 2022, and to which automakers had already agreed to do back in 2012.
I guess this is because Trump voters enjoy paying more for their gas?
Yes, apparently so. These standards would have decreased air pollution and greenhouse gas emissions and saved consumers money, but now they won't, thanks to intense lobbying from the U.S. auto industry. And Pruitt also indicated that he may try to strip the state of California of its special waiver to maintain tougher air pollution standards under the Clean Air Act, which a number of states have also adopted.
California is not, you know, the arbiter of these issues. The EPA, the DOT, and others make those decisions. California contributes as well, but that shouldn't and can't dictate to the rest of the country what these levels are going to be.
I feel like I remember this story, have seen it before, that this is what happened when the George W. Bush administration came in and they challenged California's more stringent environmental protection standards, and they won at the time in the Supreme Court. We finally turned that back, but now it looks like the same old fight again.
That is exactly what happened in the past, and it looks like the federal government now is going to participate in switching the rules back and forth and back and forth again.
And if you have any questions about this, go see the movie Who Killed the Electric Car? We had an electric car way back in the 90s called the EV1 that everybody liked who had one, and the Bush administration helped kill that. And, well, everything old and stupid is new and being done all over again, I guess.
Meanwhile, Trump's Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke has launched a new outdoor recreation advisory panel to make recommendations on public lands policy, and he's stocked it with industry representatives who have a financial interest in public lands. Washington Post reports that many of the 16 members of the new committee come from the motorized recreation vehicle industry. Other members have advocated for privatizing park services, while others represent companies with national park service contracts. Not on the advisory panel are anyone from the Outdoor Industry Association, which advocates for non-motorized activities like hiking and kayaking. But finally, some good news. The massive $1.3 trillion omnibus bill that President Trump signed last week over his own objections not only retains the current budget of the EPA and retains clean energy policies as is, it also includes a big boost to the budget of the National Park Service to make much-needed infrastructure repairs. Also, a boost for the Forest Service's firefighting and fire prevention budget, which has long been sought by conservation and forestry groups in the wake of record wildfire seasons across the nation. Also in the omnibus bill, and also very good news, a tiny town in Alaska that is threatened by climate change has finally received some federal funding to relocate. The small village of Newtok, Alaska, has been losing 70 feet of land every year due to sea level rise and coastal erosion. Congress has now appropriated $15 million to begin relocating Newtok to a safer location 9 miles inland. It's only a fraction of what's required to relocate the whole village, but it's a start.
I'll take it. For much more on all of those reports and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Though they're calling it unofficial, when North Korean leader Kim Jong-un made his first foreign visit since taking power in 2011, it was extremely significant. Kim went to Beijing this weekend, where he met with Chinese President Xi Jinping and pledged his commitment to denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula. Kim is expected to meet with South Korean President Moon Jae-in in April and to hold a summit with Donald Trump as early as May. After hearing of the meeting from Chinese President Xi, Trump tweeted, quote, maximum sanctions and pressure must be maintained at all cost.
Ecuador has cut WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange's internet connection at their London embassy, where he's been living for almost 6 years. The Ecuadorian government said Assange's behavior on social media put at risk the good relations Ecuador maintains with the United Kingdom, with other states of the European Union, and with other nations. Assange tweeted on Monday challenging Britain's accusation that Russia was responsible for the nerve agent poisoning a Russian former double agent and his daughter, and also questioned the decision by the UK and more than 20 other countries to retaliate by expelling Russian diplomats. Ecuador had cut off Assange's internet access in October of 2016, fearing he was using the web to influence the U.S. presidential election. As part of an agreement between Assange and the Ecuadorian government in 2017, after he had made comments about Spain's treatment of Catalonian separatists, Assange had agreed to not send any messages that could interfere with Ecuador's relations with other countries.
It's nearly impossible to keep track of Donald Trump's lies, threats, and attacks on the core values of our country, but since November of 2016, one determined individual has been doing just that on a weekly basis. Amy Siskind's latest book, The List, came out yesterday and is already listed as number one on Amazon's list of new releases in the politics and social sciences category. As an encore of yesterday's News in Depth, KBOO's Ray Bodwell speaks to activist Amy Siskind about her efforts to keep track of the damage she says is being done by the angry creamsicle on her website, theweeklylist.org.
I'm speaking today with author and activist Amy Siskind. After a successful 20-year career as a Wall Street executive, Amy left the financial world to co-found and serve as president of The New Agenda, a national nonprofit dedicated to improving women's lives. The New Agenda focuses on issues including economic independence and advancement, gender representation and bias, and sexual assault and domestic violence. Then, in the aftermath of the Trump election, Amy began compiling a list of actions taken by the Trump regime that she sees as a direct threat to our democratic norms. Although that list was initially a project that she just shared with friends, it soon went viral and is now viewed by millions at theweeklylist.org. Those year one lists have been compiled into a book entitled The List, a week-by-week reckoning of Trump's first year, and it's out on March 27th. Amy Siskind, thank you so much for taking the time out of what must be an incredibly busy schedule to speak with us today.
No, thank you for your kind introduction. I appreciate you having me.
You know, let me start right out with election night. For many of us, it was a true horror story. You know, what happened to you that night, and what drove you to the Weekly List? Give us a little background.
I think we were all shocked shortly after the election, as everyone was figuring out what next. I started reading articles about authoritarianism because I felt like Trump was not going to be a typical Democrat or Republican type leader. And one of the suggestions that came through, especially with Sarah Kendzior's writings, were that things would be changing and you should write down what you're experiencing today because you won't believe what will happen as time zooms on. And I happened that day, which is the Saturday after the first full week of, after the election, to go to Valkill, which is Eleanor Roosevelt's home and sort of my place for Zen and inspiration, and was taking in all of Eleanor's thoughts about government being controlled by we the people and our responsibility to democracy. And on the ride home, I just decided to take the advice that I had been reading and start to write things down. And so that first week, which was November 20th, there were just 9 items. Last week was actually 152 items, and the week before was 158. So the first year, which is encompassed in this list, which is November to November in the book, I think as we ended the year, they were around 130, 140 kind of level. They've gradually crept up as he went from being, you know, an elected official to taking office and then staffing up his regime with hands of many that are basically doing the work to deconstruct our democracy and take away regulations and protections and rights of marginalized communities and women. So now there's more hands doing it and even more chaos. So the amount of items each week is increasing, and that should be an alarm bell to us all. It tends to increase. When each first took office, it was around 30 items a week, and then quickly jumped to around 60 within the first month as he started to install people into his regime. Every week I feel like I'm saying, if you think this is the worst week, wait till next week. But I recognize the historical value and the value for all of us in terms of finding our way back when this is all over to democracy and norms. And my plan is to stick with it. Initially it was not a big time commitment. At this point, it takes between 30 and 35 hours a week. But I do plan on doing it until he's out of office, which I'm hoping is within the next year.
Yeah, sooner rather than later, we're certainly with you there. It was interesting to look in the notes section, the appendix, if you will, of your book, where you cite essentially 27 separate news sources, and virtually all of them are or have their roots in print, and I didn't see any that were in any way related to broadcast news. Was it a conscious decision on your part to avoid broadcast news as one of your sources?
Well, I tried to find every item in the book is linked, as they are on the website, to the news source. So I kind of call it sort of the antithesis of Michael Wolff's book. Like, all of this is just, you know, facts, and you can draw your own opinions. I try to present it in a way that they make some sense grouped together. So what I did with picking the sources that I use are things that are in print, so you can read them as opposed to having to watch them. And a lot of times they are things that were said in the news, so they might have been on broadcast, but then they're written down. So that way your viewers can look them up and read the full article themselves if they would like to. And I tried to limit it to reputable news sources. For the most part, it's the Washington Post is probably the number one source, and then the New York Times, Politico, CNN, NBC News are all big on breaking news. And then some of the stories are local stories, and then I cite the local media.
In the introduction to your book, you called Trump's election night the worst day since 9/11. But in some ways, it may prove in the long term to actually be worse. Clearly, the attack on 9/11 was a national tragedy. But afterwards, you know, the country pulled together, and at least until we invaded Iraq, there was sympathy for the U.S. from much of the world. Since Trump, we've become more polarized. We've kind of turned against each other at many levels and have really become a pariah in the eyes of much of the world. Assuming that we survive the Trump regime, which is by no means a given, but we're all cautiously optimistic, I wonder how long it will take to recover. And what are your biggest concerns? Do you think the damage is permanent?
That's a great question. You know, the relevancy to our country of what this is going to be is yet known. But I do believe that this is probably the greatest threat to our democracy, if not in our lifetimes, perhaps since we've been a democracy. And I think when your readers read the list, you're going to be shocked at how much you've forgotten and normalized. And I think where we are today, it's going to take us not years, perhaps a decade, to trace back to what we were before all this, all the things that he's undone in his short time in power. And also the damage, as you say, of what's been legitimized, sort of the worst of us. The first week of the list, I lament that, and Pete, you won't remember it because this is like so long ago, but the Southern Poverty Law Center in the first weeks was documenting all the cases of hate crimes against marginalized communities. People that had the ugliest of bigotry felt that they finally had their day. Last week, the Anti-Defamation League said the rise in anti-Semitism was up by 60% in the U.S. And you can, you know, cite that for any marginalized group or any subgroup that's not white, straight, Christian and male. So the damage is done. The good news is this isn't necessarily even people being aligned around Democrat, Republican. I think you're starting to see what I call the resistance, although the media doesn't seem to want to pick up on that notion, but a broadening of people, many of whom were not involved in the world of politics, mm-hmm. getting involved, and I think you're seeing that with our elections. And I think the good thing that he's done is unleashed two movements of the strength and breadth that we haven't seen in decades, and one is the high school students, who, you know, we haven't seen that since Vietnam, who are protesting around guns, but they'll all soon be voters as well. And then the Me Too movement, which I run a women's organization, and I can safely say I've never seen this level of accountability and activism around women's rights.
You know, we point to Trump, but he's not doing this alone. But since Trump has pursued many core Republican objectives like the deconstruction of Obamacare and disenfranchisement of non-white voters and on and on and on, they've kind of lined up behind him and gone along for a ride they enjoyed. But within the last 2 weeks, of course, he did briefly hint that he was going to go after some gun control. And just last week, he enacted those trade tariffs, which has many of them pulling out their hair. And, of course, now they're in a position where they can't do anything about it. They have no control over that. So do you think this is in any way a game changer? Do you think Republican leadership actually starts to step back and think that they've got to find a way to rein in the monster?
Yeah, the interesting thing when you read through the list is and people ask me, what happened to Lindsey Graham? Because in the early weeks, Lindsey Graham and Amy Klobuchar and John McCain were overseas on our behalf trying to calm our allies. There's been a real transformation of certain Republicans that early on were putting our country first and are no longer. I don't see any evidence at this point of the Republicans shifting away from him. What I see in terms of your mentioning him unilaterally imposing tariffs, him interrupting South Korean officials to say, yes, I'll meet with Kim Jong-un, is that Trump has, in his mind, he's in control now. He is a dictator in his mind. He has seized power. And I think that's alarming. And I don't know what it's going to take with the Republicans other than voting them out of office in November.
The Constitution defines punishable offenses leading to impeachment as bribery, treason, and, you know, the vague high crimes and misdemeanors. Your book, as I was rereading from the beginning, seems to document many offenses that would fall under these headings. And Special Investigator Robert Mueller is getting close, and we have a lawsuit from an adult film star that may point to election law crimes. How much longer do you think he can last?
Yeah, and I think on the Mueller probe, I've heard the analogy of an iceberg, and we only see like the very tip above the water, and that's how much we know. But we know very little of what's going on in that investigation. I do believe that he will not last out his term. I do believe that we will turn the Congress, possibly the Senate, in 2018, and I do have a strong sense that he kind of knows his end is in sight, and that's why he's taken actions in recent weeks to seize power. And if you'll notice, the people that he's kicking out aren't necessarily being replaced by anybody than the sitting cast of characters. So basically what he's doing is taking more and more power. This is an attack on our democracy by somebody who appears to be very much under the control of a foreign adversary. So I think our goal as a country, the first thing to do is to secure our democracy, and that means he's got to go. I don't view this as politics. I view this as a fight for our democracy and for our way of life. Get everybody to the polls in November. Get your friends who didn't used to vote in other states. Get them awakened. Get them involved. This is probably going to be the most important election in our lifetimes. I know that sounds trite, but we really need to make sure that we do something in November.
Amy Siskind's book is The List, a week-by-week reckoning of Trump's first year. It's incredibly well documented. It is the farthest thing from fake news you're going to find anywhere. Amy Siskind, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael and Ray Bodwell. Our producer is Kyle Qureshi. Our engineer is David Kesters. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelzel Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. And you can also find us on Facebook or on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. At 8, it's Rising Up with Sonali, with voices from last weekend's March for Our Lives protests in Los Angeles and Washington, D.C. At 9, it's Press Watch, Teresa Mitchell's weekly news and commentary program, digging deep into the news you aren't supposed to know. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, interviews, news, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, two Northwest authors, Jenny Forrester and Lydia Yuknovich, talk about their recent work. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support. To keep informed and get involved, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO, with news from your community radio station.
Good evening, this is Mike Crenshaw, and you are with us again for our weekly news segment called News from the Boo. News from in and around the KBOO community, and this evening I have a very special guest, John Ashford Jr., in the house with me. John and I go back a long way. We have a history of doing youth work together, and we're going to talk about that, and we're going to talk about some of the work that John is doing in the community currently and going into the foreseeable future. How you doing, John?
I'm doing all right, Mike.